Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to talk a little bit about Australia during the 1960s and its intervention in the Vietnam War, and moreover, Australia's relationship with its neighbours in Asia. Now, I have been remiss in not mentioning Australia and New Zealand more in the podcast. It's something I'd really like to redress, and the simple reason why is I talk about what I know and I talk about what I learn. And, you know, I'm talking about this now because I've been reading more on the subject of late. So anyway, without further ado, let's start by talking a little bit about Australia before the war. One of the key objectives of Australia at the Paris Peace Conference, because obviously Australian soldiers in the Anzac Corps had fought in Europe and the Middle East for the British Empire, the Australian Prime Minister Billy Hughes at the Paris Peace Conference went to ensure that Australia gained territories in the Pacific, particularly the island of Nauru, which was a German colony, and that Australia's interests in the Pacific and the Indian Ocean were defended. The Australians saw a very different world emerge in 1918, one where the British Empire was significantly weakened, and a newly assertive Japan to the north was able to extend its influence into the Pacific, and the Australians, like America, were under no illusion that Japan was the potential aggressor of the future and a source of potential conflict. So Australian military planners and British military planners as well were loggerheads throughout much of the 1920s and 30s on creating a realistic plan for imperial defence for the Pacific and Southeast Asia. And the model that is proposed was the Singapore strategy, whereby a large fleet would stay at the naval base at Singapore, would take on the Japanese Navy in a head-on conflict, defeat it, and then surround the Japanese islands and essentially starve them into submission in the same way that the German Second Reich, the Kaiserreich, had been starved into submission by the Royal Navy during the First World War. And the strategy was welcomed by some Australian strategists and criticised by others, that it meant that Singapore would be the first line of Australian defence. And if Singapore fell, then Australia was extremely vulnerable, and the next line of defence would essentially be Darwin. And this is basically what happens when Singapore falls in early 1942, and about 8,000 Australian soldiers are taken captive there. They'd turned up within the last few days of the fall of for Singapore to fall. Many had never even been able to fire a shot before General Percival signed the surrender to Yamashita, and the sense of outrage is palatable. Following the swift fall of Indonesia and the islands all the way up to Timor and New Guinea, Australia is officially a continent under siege. Now, there's been a number of historiographies on the question of whether or not Australia was likely to be invaded by the Japanese, and the general consensus is that the Japanese probably didn't have the manpower for such a colossal operation, having marched as far as the borders of India and occupying large parts of China and fighting a Pacific war against America. The conquering Australia as well didn't seem feasible, and it had been mooted by certain Japanese generals and commanders, but it wasn't a kind of a consensus idea. Instead, what was planned was the strangulation of Australia. What the Japanese knew is that they had started a war they could probably not finish. They had, by not knocking out the American carriers of the American Pacific Fleet at Pearl Harbor, they had a task force in the Pacific that could still fight on. And as long as they could fight on, the Americans wouldn't give up, civilian morale wouldn't break, and American civilian workers would be in factories churning out warship after warship. The Japanese would have to shelve any plans for the full invasion and seizure of Hawaii, and it meant that they were in a kind of a war of attrition in the Pacific. And so the most dangerous thing that could happen for them is if America landed armies in Australia. And this is precisely what America does. MacArthur, after he scuttles away from Corregidor and manages to get back to dry land, his first port of call is Australia. And he receives some kind of strange, perhaps undeserved, hero's welcome in Melbourne. And from there, large numbers of American Marines land, train, and build up into a fighting force until they are shipped out to places like Guadalcanal. So the strangulation of Australia is really important for the Japanese, landing, taking islands around to cut off sea lanes using aircraft and submarines and warships would mean that Australia would be brought to its knees and would perhaps not be occupied by Japan, but would fit into the new Japanese-oriented economic order as the British Empire crumbles and the US is unable to wage war effectively. So the anxieties of Australia as a kind of a white European outpost in what appears to be a hostile Asia Pacific, they don't die easily, and these anxieties really carry on throughout the remainder of the Second World War and into the post-war era. The ongoing decline of the British Empire meant that Australia had a profound sense of vulnerability. As by the 1960s, Britain is in full withdrawal from the Asia-Pacific region, with the exception of places perhaps like Hong Kong. But also it presented Australia with a challenge of the development of national identity and the development of national identity, in that Australia, as a dominion and a largely independent one, whilst it still has the king and then the queen of Great Britain as the head of state, it's an almost entirely, by the 1960s, autonomous nation, with one particular constitutional upset, which we'll hopefully have time to talk about a bit later. And the Australian government, which had been during both World Wars interested in the affairs of primarily of Australia, but also in the running of the empire as a whole, now has to really reorient itself, and obviously reorienting itself into the American sphere of influence is the kind of the obvious step. Now, during the 60s, there is a vibrant counterculture in America, and there have been some historians who have implied that really this is simply just imported from America. It's been referred to previously as activism by airmail subscription, but the evidence doesn't really support that. The historical conditions that exist in Australia are different from those in America. There are similar protests and similar struggles, but they're not exactly the same thing. The obvious oppression of Aboriginal people in Australia was one of the main strands of 1960s countercultural activism on the continent, and this really always remains, as it does in America and the struggles by and for Native American rights, as a kind of a really suppressed discourse, a thing shunted to the margins of political debate, and it has only really in the last 20 to 30 years really forced itself into the mainstream, but then with, you know, particular resistance from things like the government of John Howard, for example. So in 1962, Australia sent 30 military advisers to the South Vietnamese government. One of the main motivations behind doing this is based in this vulnerability that I've just mentioned, in that becoming close in foreign policy to the United States was seen as an essential action, given the decline of Great Britain. That pivot towards Australia during the Second World War, which had been carried out by John Curtin, was continued into the 1960s by the Liberal Prime Minister Robert Gordon Menzies. And by 1967, Britain's really kind of withdrawn from much of Asia. And the policy that Australia seems to be embracing, much like the Singapore strategy, was that of forward defence. So by preventing the falling of states in the with the domino theory to communism across Asia, you could keep communism as far to the north as possible and as far to the west as possible. And this would mean that you would not have to deal with it on your doorstep, i.e., say Indonesia, for example, which by the late 1960s has its own issues with a communist uprising and a violent communist anti-communist purge. Australia, in 1954, joins the Southeast Asia Treaty Organisation, or SEATO, which was the regional version of NATO, another kind of plank of American anti-communist containment, along with CENTO, which was the Central Powers Treaty Organization of countries like Turkey and Pakistan and then Iran. The decision to commit to the Vietnam War was then seen in this context, and the fact that Australia had been fighting in British Malaya throughout the 1950s as well to put down a communist uprising. And the Australian support for apartheid South Africa at the time, also as a kind of a fellow white dominion, also can be seen within this context. So anti-communist Cold War politics are inextricably tangled with racial politics. And Australia had a significant role to play in giving ratification and justification to South Africa. any challenge to apartheid South Africa might well have led to questions about Australia's treatment of the Aboriginal people, which was not entirely dissimilar. And the Cold War provides a one.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wonderful ideological blanket for both countries, South Africa and Australia, to be able to ignore challenges to racial segregation or dismiss them as simply Bolshevik troublemaking or what have you. Just as with the United States, Vietnam enables Australia a whole range of previously suppressed discourses on capitalism, imperialism, gender rights, environmentalism, the hot topics of the new left, to really emerge and become topics of conversation. Imperialist wars invariably empower anti-war activists to also look at connected ideas and struggles. And these filter gradually, bit by bit, into mainstream thought. And this isn't helped by the introduction in 1964 by the Menzies government of selective conscription, and the commitment of the full commitment of ground troops to Vietnam in April 1965. These are hugely popular moves to begin with, and opposition gradually develops. And they're based around fairly kind of fragile networks of peace activism and nuclear disarmament that had emerged during the 1950s. Universities become the hothouses, as they do in America and Europe, for a new left that emerges, who embraced the Vietnamese National Liberation Front as her comrades and allies, much to the rage and anger of Australia's conservative with a small c press. And much of this ferment and unrest can be explained quite simply by growing educational success in Australia, the boom in university and high school, secondary high school completion rates, and the numbers of students attending universities, particularly from working class and European migrant backgrounds. One historian, Hannah Forsyth, says that by the mid-1960s, students from a much wider range of backgrounds were enrolling, and this challenged the previous pro-establishment elitism of universities, that they were normally sort of factories for turning out members of the ruling class with ruling class sympathies. The democratisation in Australia of university education in the 1960s had interesting, to say the least, results in terms of countercultural politics and protest. Now, you might remember me having talked about the German counterculture some while ago. It's a long-buried podcast back there somewhere. And the German counterculture had a particular relevance, or the Vietnam War has a particular relevance to the German counterculture, in that Germany saw itself, or the West German students saw themselves and their country as an outpost of American imperialism. American B-52s flew round trips to Vietnam. There was a American airbase at Ramstein, an American hospital for veterans being taken home from Vietnam. And so in Australia, a similar phenomena occurs. In Australia, you have the countercultural student body saying, well, what are we going to be? A poor man's America, an American imperialist outpost, or are we going to become an Asian country? And this is these are the sort of terms that they are speaking in. Are we going to become a country within Asia? And this, there has been a vein of this thinking that runs really up to the present day of what exactly is Australia? Is it simply an Anglo-American stroke European outpost in the Pacific, or is it really a country in Asia in its own right? And I suppose as Australia becomes a more diverse society, the debate becomes more complex, and Australia's sense of itself and identity starts to change as it becomes less majority Anglo-European white. And this brings us really to the discussion of the Australian White Australia policy, which really meant that only white immigration was allowed into Australia, which was it was introduced in 1901, and the policy meant that only white races could immigrate to Australia, and the definition of whiteness was extremely racially fraught. It's one of the complaints that Japan brings to the Paris Peace Conference in 1919, and when America, wanted to prevent, Woodrow Wilson wanted to prevent mass Japanese immigration to California, support Australia's white Australia policy and its continuation of it, you know, so the Australia First policy, the Japanese see this as a mortal insult, and it's one of the things that leads to profound alienation of Japan to the rest of the European and American powers. The Australian Labour Party renounced their support for the policy in 1965, and the following year the Federal Immigration Department changes the Migration Act, which allows, though does not encourage, large-scale non-European migration. And this is the beginnings of a kind of a much more multicultural society in Australia that can be observed now. If Vietnam presented a worry to Australia, then China was certainly the epicentre of Australian concerns in the 1960s, particularly on the political right, which has always been extremely active in Australian politics. You only need to look at the development or almost of kind of proto-fascist parties on the right in Australia in the late 1930s. Australia's kind of most inglorious and probably most incompetent and lazy general, Blamey, was kind of tied up in this sort of politics before the war, and all sorts of nefarious activities during the war. So the view that the Australian political right had was that subversion and communism was spreading from China southwards. The radical left saw China as being a potential, from 1949 onwards, a potential ally, particularly the Communist Party of Australia, who sent activists to China in the 50s and 60s for training, which is a a really interesting facet of party behaviour, because these were parties affiliated previously via Comintern, and then following Comintern via other means to Moscow. And the Sino-Soviet split puts immense pressure on any affiliation to China, but you obviously had Australian communists recognising the validity of Maoism as opposed to Marxist-Leninism. So between 1968 and 71, there is this obviously wave of radicalisation in politics in Australia, so much so that you have similar kinds of countercultural actions that you see in America, protesters seizing the US consulate in Melbourne. And they are profoundly influenced by the Cultural Revolution in China, or the version of the Cultural Revolution that they get. Any reasonable scholar of the Cultural Revolution probably has precious little positive things to say about it, but it didn't mean that in the 1960s and 70s that there weren't Europeans, Americans and Australians looking to Mao as an example of how to reorder society. Much has been written, for example, about the appeal of Mao to French students in 1968. One student activist in Australia said, "The Cultural Revolution in 1967 looked like Mao had gone to the masses. Young people were revolutionists, as if the same thing happening in China was happening in the West." Well, that's quite a, I suppose, an understandably naive claim to make. You know, when none of us are in full command of the facts when events are occurring. But it's important to recognise that there are powerful distinctions between Mao's Cultural Revolution of the 60s and 70s and countercultural activity in the West during the same period of time. Much of Mao's countercultural activity is profoundly state-led. Mao was inspiring students to behave in particular ways, and after them, he fosters essentially a civil war in China. The same cannot be said for students seizing parts of Paris or Chicago, or in this case, Melbourne. Australians saw China in the 1960s as a source of, mainly I suppose, of nightmares, but some looked upon it as a source of inspiration. One clothing worker in Victoria in 1970 wrote, "Whoever wants to know a thing has no way of doing so except by coming into contact with it, that is by living, practicing in its environment." And this meant that young people should go to China as a delegation to gain knowledge and experience of how Chinese people live and work with Mao Zedong thought. And these interactions did happen, and they were closely monitored by Australia's security services. Travellers going back and forth to China were seen in kind of rather predictable Cold War terms. Gough Whitlam himself, the Labour leader, travelled to China in 1971, just prior to Nixon's visit to China. Nixon, for example, is seen as kind of bulletproof because he is a staunch anti-communist, whereas Whitlam was obviously criticised as he was a figure on the left of Australian politics and seen as sympathetic and kind of treasonous. And if it was difficult for Whitlam to visit to China without being criticised, then the Aboriginal peoples in Australia who hoped to connect with radical countercultural and Maoist politics were even more vilified. The development of an Australian Black Panther Party in 1971 and the attempts by Australian Aboriginal groups to appeal to Maoist China were seen, treated both with kind of ridicule and fear by majority white Australian society. China, of course, had precious little interest in the struggles of Aboriginal peoples, despite Mao's protestations that his revolution would liberate the Third World and also liberate colonially oppressed peoples worldwide. When it came to having friendly relations with the, or friendlier relations with the Australian government, and therefore trading connections, there was no question whatsoever that China would embrace the struggles of Aboriginal peoples, realpolitik as ever triumphs. Anyway, listen, I'm going to leave it there for now. I want to talk more about Australia in the near future. If you want to read more on this subject, read John Piccini's excellent essay, Australia, the Long 1960s and the Winds of Change in the Asia Pacific. And you can get that on academia.edu. And also remember, if you can give us a vote or a like or, you know, a thumbs up or some description on the iTunes Explaining History page, that would be fantastic because it really helps this podcast to grow. And I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. All the best. Bye bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.